Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.
Hello, I'm Helen.
And I'm Stephen.
And welcome to the New Statesman podcast.
This week we discuss Brexit.
Of course we discuss Brexit, but we talk about the votes in the House of Commons this week.
We talk about what deal the EU27 might accept.
And Helen Thompson of Cambridge University joins us to look about all the other European leaders and what they're thinking. Stephen, do we have to talk about the bad running of the Brexit referendum?
Yes, I think we should talk about the conduct of the referendum campaign. Essentially, minutes before we sat down here in the podcast catacomb, Vote Leave has been censured by the Electoral Commission.
So it's been fined, what, about £60,000-ish, roughly?
Yeah, so they've been given the highest possible fine in both sort of categories. And Darren Grimes of Believe, which has been found to not effectively be a separate campaign, but an adjunct of Vote Leave, has been referred to the police, as has...
And they overspent by $500,000.
Yeah, as has the designated hitter of... So essentially...
Of Vote Leave itself.
Yeah, when you have any kind of campaign, you have an agent or officials. Basically, they are legally liable for if you break the law.
I got to say... Okay, actually, I was about to say something wildly libelous. I mean, try and rephrase it to be slightly less wildly libelous. Whoever took on the role of being legally liable for a campaign that involved some of the people who were involved in that campaign was a very, 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 very brave person indeed.
So I have a great deal of opinions, many of them slightly contradictory about this, but kind of in no particular order. One of the many problems with referendums is I cannot work out. Now, I think it's fairly clear to me that UK election regulation is just not fit for purpose for a variety of reasons. However, I cannot conceive of any regulation you can have in a referendum that doesn't make you a fool not to try and bend those rules. Because unlike with a political party where, I mean, so even if...
Well, you disband afterwards, right?
Yeah,
so that's the point. It's not going to dog you for ages. You just go bankrupt or whatever.
Even if the fine wasn't a faintly comical £20,000 in one of the two cases, a sum that, you know, the wider Leave movement can very easily...
They can eat that, yeah.
Yeah, that is not an existential... But even if you were handing out kind of existential sums, right, even if you did have a GDPR level hammer, well, ultimately, in a referendum campaign, there will at some point, of course, be another campaign on our membership of the European Union. There will be another constitutional referendum in Scotland. But these campaigns will not be, you know, like...
They won't be successor campaigns, will they? There'll be phrases entirely new, fresh, legal. Yeah.
And so while with issues of national determination and perhaps with some constitutional protection, yeah, there is no real option other than a referendum, with anything else, it just does create really bad incentives. However, I do find it deeply irksome seeing various kind of, you know, people moving seamlessly from it was advisory, ignore it, to it was won by cheating, ignore it. Not least because ultimately, if you don't think that the Remain campaign didn't bend the spirit of the referendum,
I have a
£9 million leaflet from the government to sell you.
The government put out that incredibly badly designed leaflet, which was basically some, you know, intern's first day on Microsoft Word to tell you about why the European Union was great in punishing non-illustrated detail, right? Compared with Vote Leave, which had that kind of crazy, yes, everyone from Iraq is going to move here, which, you know, was a lie, but it was a very beautiful, graphically designed lie.
But equally, it does annoy me seeing various kind of pro-Brexit commentators and kind of Vote Leave outriders going, well, everyone bent the spirit of the rule. Well, if everyone bent the spirit of the rule and you managed to do your bending of the spirit so badly that you actually broke the law, well, I'm sorry, I have no sympathy with you then facing the full... It's kind of a bit like, I mean, actually, to take an example of a law I don't agree with, are drug laws, right? Now, lots of people, particularly some of the teenagers in the block, occasionally have a toke, right? A couple of weeks ago, a bike crashed outside. There were police and ambulance on. Some idiot decided that they were going to light up at that moment, right? And they successfully became the first person in the history of our estate to actually be arrested for smoking cannabis, right? Now, I'm sorry, it's not a defense to go, but hundreds of other people in this block aren't so stupid that they don't go, oh, I'm going to light up in front of the cop.
Hey, 5-0, have a bit of this.
Yeah. And equally, it is not a defense of why I should not be prosecuted for breaking referendum limits, that other people tried to do it, but did it within the spirit of the rules. No, you broke the law. Sorry, them's the breaks.
I also think that on a wider point, actually, it's not exactly a diversion because I think it's very important. But if you look at the Irish referendum, I know I harp on about the Irish referendum for repealing the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution, the abortion ban. There was a lot of money pumped into the Save Both, the No campaign from clearly the American pro-life movement. Like, until Facebook and Google banned advertising on the subject in Ireland, there was people's, were telling me that their Facebook feed was full of this stuff. Like, clearly people were, in that case, probably not the law, certainly the spirit of the law that you don't pile huge amounts of money into dark advertising that really can't be seen in other countries' electoral processes. And you know what happened? First of all, Facebook and Google finally woke up to the problem, like after a really, really long time, and agreed to do something about it. And second of all, it didn't work because the other side had a proper campaign, had debated it for a really long time beforehand, had a proper white paper that they put out showing what the legislation would be like afterwards. Like, there were lots of other things that the other side did a lot better than Remain, and a lot of ways in which the referendum was structured a lot better so that didn't have the impact that it did, right? So I think it's very tempting to focus on the fact that Vote Leave are, have indulged in a lot of skullduggery. Probably the more interesting question, if you're a journalist is, or a policymaker, is how do you change the rule so that this doesn't happen next time? And that's the bit I'm not sure we're going to get to.
One of the many, many problems with the kind of holding of the referendum is that it has in many ways made Britain ungovernable, not least because it's done terrible things to the coalitions of the big two political parties in a way that makes it quite difficult to look at either of them and work out how they could get more votes.
Than 40%.
Yeah.
That's the thing I think is fascinating. Is I didn't tweet this because I just can't be bothered. But if you look at the fact that Kate Hoey Frankfield, Kelvin Hopkins and Graham Stringer walked through the...
No, so Kelvin Hopkins... Well, it depends on which division.
On some of the divisions,
on the closest
anyway.
Division, Kelvin Hopkins voted with the Labour whip, despite not being a Labour MP at the present time.
Due to... yes, but I just thought there's an alternate universe in which lifelong rebel and Eurosceptic backbencher Jeremy Corbyn probably voted with those people.
I don't know. So, and again, I feel that every week I say, when it gets quiet, I will do my what are the various flavors of Labour Leaver. Ultimately, I think Corbyn would, if he weren't leader, have ended up in the kind of Skinner, Hopkins, Ronnie Campbell level, right? Now, if you listen to, I'm slightly concerned I've got Ronnie Campbell's surname wrong, but I'm just going to plow on. If you listen to Ronnie Campbell on the European Union, he will talk about how awful it is. He doesn't like it. He's obviously happy about the result. But on votes where there is suddenly an opportunity to defeat the government, he will vote.
Okay.
Whereas the crucial difference between Field, Hoey and Stringer and the you basically kind of, I think it's effectively there are three Labour leavers who will vote with the government regardless. There are another four, and I think if Jeremy and John were not on the front benches, they would be in this kind of six, who will vote with the government, vote against the government when they think the government will fall, but they will not vote on procedural Brexit issues where the government won't fall. They won't vote to soften Brexit. Then you have your kind of Caroline Flynn, Gareth Snell, Laura Smith. Won't vote in ways that my constituents get annoyed by. The reason why I think the government is in considerable danger, particularly over customs, is it is not an issue. I'm yet to speak to a Labour MP in either of those second two groups who either goes, this is an ideologically important part of leaving for me, or goes, this is a point that I think that people who voted to leave care about. And provided you are the Labour Party and you can deliver those two groups, you can defeat the government.
Right. So because they vote with the Labour Party, they don't help the government out by part, like in the way that, like, the fact that the three, well, and on those divisions last night, the government only won one of them by, what was it, 312 to 315?
No, it was 303 to 300. Because, I mean, one of the...
Oh, God, let's not talk about pairing. No one needs this.
No, I think pairing is an important issue. And
no, I do too, but yeah. It also just makes me want to stick spears into my eyes, yeah. Because it is the source of so many bad takes on the internet that I, you know, like, such and such a person didn't turn up for the vote, such and such a person didn't do this. And you're like, yeah, because they've just literally... I mean, I think hasn't... I don't know if Laura Pidcock, for example, is off on maternity leave. I don't know if she voted last night.
But... Well, particularly because last night was...
But Joe Swinson was going through the lobby when she was 1 week overdue. Like, yeah. Sometimes people have to miss votes because they're literally in a maternity hospital.
And also last night's close vote was not a vote that people expected to be close, literally, until about 8 o'clock. Labour
MPs, because Gutto Beb resigned for backing the government's position at lunchtime on Monday, right?
Yeah. So this is the thing. Is at lunchtime at Monday... Labour had a two-line whip, which is essentially a, look, we'd like you to vote this way, but if you can't make it for, you know, if you let us know that, you know, you've got a hospital appointment or a school play, do you know what, live your life. Then, because ultimately Labour's position was, these
it's
ERG
pass,
amendments are a joke, we are just not interested in that. Then suddenly the government said they would support the ERG amendments, and immediately you had a bunch of Tory Remainers being like, I'm sorry, what? So then suddenly the Labour Party went, actually, it's a three-line whip and you need to be there. But obviously, if you are someone on maternity leave in Durham or you're a Scottish MP who's said you can get permission to go, you can't very easily get
back.
You literally
can't get back.
Which
you won't be able to until Harriet Harman's plan for proxy voting comes in, which we should all support.
Yeah, it's the thing. So some of the people who've been getting a hard time on Twitter, I both feel sorry for and I also deeply don't, right? Because basically every...
Are you talking about Tim Farron and Vince Cable?
Yeah, because every time there is a close vote, actually less so in this current incarnation of the Lib Dem press office, but under Tim Farron and before that, they used to do this an awful lot when they would go, oh, if only X
blah,
more
blah,
had
blah.
Turned up,
yeah.
Then we would have won. And it's just like, no, that's not true. And you know it's not true. And if you live by that kind of incredibly disingenuous politics, then you deserve, frankly, to die by that incredibly disingenuous mode of doing politics.
Right. Well, put that in your pipe and smoke it, Vince Cable. Stephen Spoken. Is there anything else that has happened this week that is interesting? So there's some weird thing about the government deciding to try and go to recess early, which has the sort of slight air of someone kind of ringing a doorbell and running away.
And yeah, it's a bit go home, the Conservative Party, you're drunk. Also, so I, in a slightly shameful moment in my free morning email, so late last night, in the spirit of the no question is too stupid to ask out loud, I was having drinks with a variety of senior Conservatives and some other journalists, and I basically said, look, this plan to move it early, it doesn't matter. You can all plan on WhatsApp and won't you be more? And then I was very confidently told by everyone else present that this is not true and then you can't have a no confidence when there is no Parliament for MPs to hold it in. However, since then, I have looked this up and this isn't... So I don't think this can possibly be the case. However, as with some of the elements of the Fixed Term Parliaments Act, despite
that's
if a large
I didn't
number
understand.
Of Tory MPs believe something to be true and Downing Street believes something to be true about the Conservative Party's internal rules, but the literal interpretation of it is that is not true. Is it true?
Do you know, if it was Labour, I would be heading towards an extremely tense 19-hour NEC meeting. But
yeah,
what's the version of that in the Conservative Party?
So they similarly have a ruling body that is elected in ways that are just far too lengthy to go into at this moment. But it doesn't have the same interpretive function. The 1922 committee, which represents backbench MPs.
So King Graham Brady basically gets to wield his sword of justice.
But the thing is, I cannot conceive of a situation in which Graham Brady gets 48 letters over the summer, looks at it and goes, I'm in Ibiza.
I too cannot envisage that, having met Graham Brady.
I therefore can't be bothered to do this. I think a lot of commentary about Graham Brady seems to ignore the fact that he's a young, by the standards of MP, he's a young guy. He's not yet 50. He doesn't want
I guess it's just when someone talks about grammar schools that much, I sort of mentally add 10 years to their physical appearance.
Yeah. But he doesn't want his career to end at the same time as Theresa May's, right? This idea that he'd sit, someone picks up a phone and says, Graham, I've just sent a letter, and he's just like,
sorry, I can't.
That's not going to happen. However, I do think the there are 48 names reportage does suffer a bit the same problem as the Labour has the numbers to defeat the EEA thing, which is actually when you sit down with a list of the 300 Tory MPs and try to find 48 Tory MPs who are silly enough believe them that would be a good idea, can't get to 48.
The rumour that I loved was the idea that the whip thought it'd be a really good idea to force the no confidence vote, which they thought she would win, because then you can't have another one for a year under the rules. And therefore they would do that. And I think it was Duncan Robinson of the FT who tweeted that would be the banter timeline way of doing it. I do not just feel that would be the kind of thing that the Whip's incredibly clever plan to get to force a fake confidence vote in Theresa May ended up bringing down Theresa May is like very 2018.
Well, the thing is, I actually think it is harder. Yeah, having sat down with the, as I did when we did the EEA numbers, and I sat down and literally picked up a phone and went, I basically with the EEA, I drew a plausible list of Labour MPs who I thought might rebel if they were forced to vote to keep us in the EEA. I knew that I had to get to a certain number, and basically once I got to a number where I could go, this is a nonsense story, you can't get the numbers, I wrote it up. And similarly with the 48, I found it very difficult to get to even kind of 25, right? Of Tory MPs who are, there's a big difference in going, I'm annoyed, and going, I'm actually going to do this. You just get a lot more of like, yeah, but what could we do? However, if the whips did decide, and I don't think that story was anything other than paper talk, but if the Tory whips did decide to trigger a leadership confidence vote, I actually think weirdly her chances of losing it once it started are actually quite high, because once it started...
Oh yeah, once it started, the process has happened. It's you kind of think, well, we're going to have this embarrassing thing that's happening in front of everybody where it's really obvious how disunited we are.
And a bunch of people think she has to go at some point. So you kind of go, okay, well, if it has to be,
if it's a choice between her staying on for at least another year and us getting a new leader now, then you can see...
Like the coup coups against Jeremy Corbyn in 2016, where you had a bunch of people with sort of ill-conceived half plans, and then kind of the first ill-conceived half plan goes off, and then the owners of the other kind of two ill-conceived half plans are like, oh, well, if we're going, we better detonate now. And obviously all they did was blow up themselves. And that, I think, is a similar dynamic if you did get to 48.
Yeah, what I'm saying is, Julian Smith, I'm sure you listen to the New Statesman podcast. Don't do it. You might think it'd be banter. It might not very well be banter.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And now we're joined by a special guest person in the podcast, Broom Cupboard, Helen Thompson, Professor of Political Economy at the University of Cambridge, and also from the Talking Politics podcast. Let's say the joint first best politics podcast in Britain, obviously. And I'd like to think we're the other one, but we're probably not, Stephen.
I assumed you were talking about reasons to be cheerful.
Yeah. How you wound me. Helen, you come in to talk about football, but we thought we'd grab you to talk a bit about Brexit, because who can ever be tired of talking about Brexit? Certainly not me. Is there any Brexit deal that can pass the House of Commons?
It's hard to see one at the moment, because if you look at what's happening with this white paper, you've now got dissent from both sides with what Justin Greening has done. And at the very least, you would have thought that Theresa May had to keep the, let's describe them as Remainers, but that wing of her party together over this. The only thing that I would say, and I think is that we all who spend our time commenting about politics need to take this to some extent on board, is that things are changing very quickly in the international world. That Trump is a massively disruptive factor in world politics. at the moment. And I think that this issue in relation to the European Union has clearly not played itself out, and it may yet still, I think, have ramifications where Brexit's concerned.
I think that's really interesting, because there's a weird kind of elastic thing about Donald Trump, right, which is actually his visit at the weekend when he basically nuked from orbit Theresa May in the middle of having dinner with Theresa May.
Yeah.
And then weirdly, the next day she's there holding his hand again, having a press conference like nothing had happened. I think the really odd thing I find about Donald Trump is that he blows apart the kind of international order, but there's this kind of muscle memory where everyone just continues as if he hasn't just kind of...
I think in some perverse way that she was strengthened by the Trump aspects of what happened last week by the end.
In what way?
Of it. Partly because he did backtrack, and partly because it brought people to be sympathetic to her who weren't previously sympathetic, because then suddenly it looks like, okay, there is a, you know, a certain concept of Brexit that, let's say, Johnson and Farage are representing, which involves moving Britain very close to the United States. And then lots of people who would really rather still be in the European Union think, well, okay, if the choice is Theresa May's version of Brexit subject to what the EU might actually agree or not, or that, then we're with Theresa May.
I thought that was the interesting thing about the Ma interview. I don't know what you felt about that. But the thing that she couldn't quite articulate about the common rules area was that there's already a big problem with us moving closer to US standards on any kind of trade deal, which is just the same thing that sank TTIP. People don't want chlorinated chicken. They don't want to have the kind of food standards, for example, agricultural standards that America's already got. So the idea of a kind of big, amazing free trade deal with America was kind of pre-knackered already, no matter what we ended up, where we ended up with on alignment.
Yeah, and particularly once you kind of get into the issues around the Irish border. I mean, also the slight weirdness of the whole we should have a US trade deal is that the sovereignty argument about the problem of being within the regulatory orbit of the European Union is entirely correct. However, I am yet to hear an argument as to why there is a difference from a sovereignty perspective between being yoked to one regulatory hegemon as opposed to another, other than a kind of ideological fixation that some Brexiteers have on one party within the United States. And people quite like European regulation. Yeah, every time you poll people on, you know, how you feel about Regulation X, they actually quite like red tape. They don't like it when you call it red tape, but it does make it essentially impossible to move away from it, even if you have the freedom to.
Yeah, that's one of the things
diverge.
I find interesting is the fact that, you know, Daily Mail ran really big campaigns against what it called Frankenfoods, you know, genetically modified foods. A lot of the kind of stuff that would be much more in the American sphere of regulation than the European sphere is really not that popular here. But Helen, I want to come back to this idea you said about things moving very fast in Europe. What do you think are the kind of main chess pieces on the board with that?
I think the main thing, it's hard to say what the main thing is, but one of the main things.
Yeah.
Is that Trump is subjecting Germany to pretty fierce attack. I mean, it's not just, I think, the language that he's using. I mean, take, for example, the language he was using about Germany and Russia and basically saying that Germany had sold itself out to Russia for energy, for gas in particular. I think that's actually only a means to an end to what he's actually concerned about, which is the trade aspect of it, is that he wants a confrontation with Germany about trade. And he does think about it as Germany more than as about the European Union. And so he's just not prepared to observe what some people might say the fiction, some people might say the reality of the European Union having a trade policy, and you can only deal with the EU as the EU as trade. He's using his ambassador in Germany to try to stoke divisions within German politics, to try to basically make some alliance with the German car makers, particularly the Bavarian car makers, tie that to what's going in terms of Germany's internal politics. And I think it's reasonable to see, it's plausible at least, to see the way in which a lot of pressure about Germany on trade that involves the car makers, particularly and other manufacturers actually in Bavaria, putting pressure via the CSU issue with the Christian Democrats, the internal division within the German government at the moment, and them saying, look, we're not dealing with a confrontation with the United States about trade that involves tariffs and then having no deal Brexit. Now, that could work out to the government's advantage. It could not, because at the same time, we're not entirely sure, I think, is to what Trump's end game is where this is concerned. I mean, you know, is it actually that, I mean, one way of looking at it would be to say, okay, the two countries that he's got in his fire line, if you like, at the moment most is Germany and China. Which of them matter to him? Okay. Which of them matter to him most? Is it actually Germany or is it China?
This isn't something you're going to hear very much on this podcast, but does he have a point about, particularly, one of the things he mentioned was the Russian pipeline that's going to supply Germany's, you know, and it does, you know, lots of the other Baltic states feel that they're being bypassed in that, as I understand, they're quite unhappy about it. Does he have a point about that, about the fact that Germany's interests are therefore tied up quite heavily with Russia's in terms of its energy supply?
I think that he's right in the sense of describing a certain reality. this is a reality that's long been true. I mean, Germany and other European countries, more central European countries than, you know, than Britain, have been energy dependent on what was then the Soviet Union from the 1970s onwards. I mean, Italy was even trying to make deals with the Soviet Union about oil and gas back in the 1950s. I think where he hasn't got a point is it's not really plausible to expect Germany to change. I mean, aside from anything else, is they can't do, Germany couldn't do what Trump wants, or says he wants anyway, which is to start buying liquid natural gas imports, because they don't have any liquid natural gas port infrastructure. It takes a long time, or considerable year, and any significant number of years to accumulate that. So there is no possibility that even in the medium term, I think that Germany is going to change tack about this. And even if it wanted to, as a long-term project, then I think it would have to bear in mind as to whether the United States is actually going to be able to maintain its position, which only acquired last year, of being a natural gas net exporter, how long shale gas in the United States is going to last. Now, it's obviously very difficult judging what Trump does and doesn't understand. I think he probably understands something of that. And I suspect that actually he's not really expecting Germany to turn around and say, okay, we're abandoning Nord Stream 2 and we're going to buy natural gas imports. He's using it to put pressure on them about the thing that I think he does care about, which is the size of Germany's trade surplus.
But that also makes me think of his comments about refugees, because Merkel's decision to admit a million refugees from Syria and other places is something that's particularly caused ruptures with, as you say, Bavaria. So him pushing that idea of the kind of this Muslim wave coming into Europe both furthers his goals in terms of ethnic nationalism and also has the happy side effect of the fact that Merkel is relying on a coalition partner that has its power base in the region most affected and most unhappy about that.
Yeah, I think that the one thing that he does understand how to do is disruptive politics. And one of the reasons why he's good at it, or in this sense good at it, is because he doesn't take seriously the way that liberals talk about the way the international order exists. He goes for the hypocrisies of it, the fictions of it, and he doesn't just critique them. He acts like that they're not real. So you can turn around and say something like, okay, doesn't he understand? Isn't he he's so ignorant? He doesn't understand that the EU determines trade policy, not the German government. But he's actually trying to show, I think, that actually when it comes to it, when it really matters, you can get the German government to engage in trade policy independently of the EU.
And what about Emmanuel Macron, presumably currently sleeping off, I would imagine, a fairly epic hangover after France winning the World Cup?
Well, we were talking about Macron and on the football podcast. I think in terms of symbolically for Macron, this really is a massive moment, because the France is back rhetoric was really quite important to the Macron project. And that's basically said that we cannot have a situation where the European Union looks like it's dominated by Germany rather than dominated by the long-standing French-German axis. And I think you can say that what the Hollande presidency did was to basically sideline France at the core of the European Union. So the World Cup, I think, is symbolically a big deal for Macron. What it doesn't obviously solve is political problems in themselves. Because he's still in a position where what he wants most from the German government in terms of significant Eurozone reform is not going to happen. And it isn't just because the Germans aren't on side with it, that the German government's not on side with it, but there's any number of other now European EU governments are not on side of it. There's this new Hanseatic League. Well, it's not a new Hanseatic League, but that's the way that it's been described, which I think it's got up to 12 members the last time that I looked.
Explain who those people are for those of us whose Hanseatic League knowledge might not be quite
well.
What
they're
it could
they're
be.
Basically northern central European states. So they now include Austria. They're probably led by the Netherlands. But interestingly, Ireland has joined this group now. That wasn't the first time, which a coalition saying no to Eurozone for the Eurozone reform, and particularly in terms of no to anything that looks like a debt union. So In this sense, Macron's actually more politically isolated on the Eurozone than he was when he started. And I think that if you look in terms of French domestic politics, then he's also not in as strong a position as he was even 6 months ago, as his approval ratings are around the 40% level.
So what does he want? Does he want essentially greater integration?
I think that he wants... It's a paradox, or maybe it's not a paradox, it's two things that are not necessarily contradictory with each other. He wants greater integration at the core, in the sense of he wants something that looks more like shared liabilities, particularly when it regards to the Eurozone. And I think at the same time, though, he wants weaker terms of membership for Eastern Europe states, potentially beyond that as well. So essentially a two-tier European Union where the core integrates more, but not in ways that would mess around with what he would think of as French sovereignty, about fiscal matters in particular. And at the same time, that he does not want the East European members in particular to be able to impede, as he sees, I think, that they're able to at the moment, what he wants to happen at the core.
The thing that a lot of Commission officials talk about as a potential solution to Brexit is that the United Kingdom ends up in an association agreement, essentially an outer ring where it kind of floats around and then the problem goes away. Now, there are obviously lots of things you can critique about that as being wildly optimistic, but how does that work for Macron in terms of his objectives?
I think that Macron would quite like that way of doing things. I think he said actually in the Sorbonne speech, and it gave in the first autumn after he'd been elected, that he could see a role for, or place rather, for Britain in some outer tier. I think that the difficulty is that the EU would first have to resolve how it's going to accommodate two tiers within a single legal and constitutional order. And I don't think it's got any idea about, really, at the moment, about how to do that, because that's going to involve unravelling quite a lot of treaty law, and indeed, in some sense, the whole legal and constitutional principle on which the European Union works. But if you could get there first, then I think it's possible to see some kind of position for Britain in that tier. I think, interestingly, it goes back to the point that you made earlier about what's the difference between being regulatory aligned with the European Union in regard to sovereignty in the United States. And I think one answer is because the European Union has bound up this regulatory question with the European Court of Justice, and the European Court of Justice is committed essentially to interpretations of European law that move towards ever closer union. So actually using a court like that, that's got that kind of commitment from members who aren't actually in the legal and constitutional order that's supposed to be moving to ever closer union is pretty difficult. And I think that the European Union wants something like where Macron says he wants to go anyway, is going to have to get to grips with that problem.
But not to be all like, you don't hear about this in the hated MSM, but one of the reasons that I listen to the Talking Politics podcast is you do look at Europe really in big thematic ways and in quite a lot of pretty crunchy detail, which you can do in a podcast, right? Because it's people talking, it's not going to bore you to tears. And the same thing, we've made a conscious effort in the last couple of years in the New Statesman to really improve our coverage of European affairs. You know, the FT does it very well. But I think all the Brexit coverage, and this is something that Alan Rusbridge alluded to in his piece about the BBC, it's still covered as kind of an argument within Britain that then we take to them, and then they go, okay, well, thank you for coming up with your idea of Brexit. And there is really, I think it would really help our understanding of Brexit to understand the fact that the European Union has got a lot of other stuff on its plate, right? They don't want to keep us haunting summits for the next 5 years going, hello, we still haven't sorted out Brexit. How's that all kind of coming along?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that it's a curse really on both sides of the debate in this country as it was conducted in the referendum campaign itself and since, is that the European Union, as the European Union, as the political entity it is, scarcely features in the British debate about Brexit. I mean, either it's some monster which can be left behind literally almost in some sense by slaying it, or it's some symbol of what it means to be not British or beyond British, or British as part of something bigger or multicultural or liberal or multilateral. And actually that it's a very distinctive political order.
Or occasionally that Merkel's in charge of it, right? There was that David Davis thing where he had a series of tweets where he said, basically what we're going to do after we've done Brexit, after we've voted to leave, is we're going to turn up and we're going to go and talk to Merkel and then she's going to sort it out for us.
Yeah, I think there's some, I mean, I think that that's obviously was naive presented exactly like that. I think that there was some truth to that in this sense, is that one of the unintended consequences of Brexit was that it really weakened Merkel's position within the European Union. So I think you could tell the story of what decision-making in the European Union from probably around the time of Hollande's election, maybe a little bit after that, through to Brexit, as this is the Merkel show, that pretty much every major decision was being made by Merkel and that others accepted that that's what the rules of the game were. Indeed, I heard a former head of government of one of the EU member states saying pretty much that this was actually after the time period that I'm talking about. But I think that
because Brexit, she was so dominant in her country, and also because Germany was so rich and doing so well and was in the bailout position.
Yeah, I think that also, yeah, one of the things that the Eurozone crisis did was to strengthen Germany's position in this way, because basically enacting as the ones who decided the rules about the allocation of credit, albeit along with the European Central Bank, it had a new means of making side payments to other states. And the ways in which that she dealt with the migration crisis in 2015, and I think crucially into 2016, and the Turkey deal was very much about Merkel. But Brexit began.
That's the Turkey deal to keep Syrian refugees in Turkey.
Yeah, but I think Brexit began a process whereby that she has lost that influence even before we get to the German election, and I think that is in part because within Germany, but also within another number of other European countries, that blame was attached to Merkel for Brexit happening.
In terms of because the idea that a lot of kind of what I would describe as the non-headbanging Brexiteers is that at the 11th hour, there will still come a point where member states intercede. Now, obviously, we are quite close to the 11th hour now. Do you think then that is still a possibility, or then one of the consequences of Merkel's sort of greater weakness and the kind of opposition from Rutte and other people towards what Macron wants to do is that there is not really the capacity within the EU at present for that kind of 11th hour intervention?
I think that is quite a plausible interpretation, yeah. It's not clear what the European Union collective position is. Now, clearly, they have a set of short-term negotiating tactics and to some extent ends to which that they agree. But when it comes to making the kind of existential decision, what kind of relationship does the European Union want with Britain in the future? I don't think that you would bet on the European Union being able to give a coherent answer to that any more than the British government can come up with a coherent answer as to what it thinks that relationship should be. And I think that's part, I've been thinking about this over the last few days, I think that's part of a kind of, it says something about the nature of what the European Union political project became, that we're in this position whereby a member state withdraws its consent to being in the European Union, and nobody quite knows what to do now that that has happened, because there's not room in the script for either in British politics, I think, partly because really to seize that and to run with that aspect of the story would be have to say, okay, that economic questions are going to have a secondary place. We'll have to accept some material sacrifice to have, in some sense, what's become, our ability to govern ourselves in a democratic sense. And I don't think that our politicians know how to have that kind of politics. And at the same time, the European Union would have to get beyond its limitations in dealing with substantive existential questions, because it has a tendency either to say there's a set of rules and procedures to follow and we follow the rules and the procedures and the decision comes out the other end, or when clearly the rules don't work, as in the migration crisis in the summer of 2015, then you get arbitrary decision-making from the most powerful player at that time. And that doesn't work either, because even in Merkel's terms, she had to retreat. So in some sense, I think we're in some political space where
really what you're saying is everything is broken and no one knows how to fix it.
Yeah, nobody knows what to do.
Well, what a cheery note to end on. Helen Thompson, thank you very much for joining us. And you can hear more from Helen and the rest of the Cambridge University crew on Talking Politics. And And now for a section we like to call
You Ask Us.
You've lost some of your enthusiasm, Stephen. That's upsetting to me. This week's You Ask Us comes from Ewan, and it's about the Labour Party's adoption of a definition of anti-Semitism that is not as strong as the IHRA. Am I getting my acronym right there?
Yes. So the Labour Party's code of conduct does include part of the IHRA definition, which I keep calling the IRA definition.
But probably don't do that in public. Yeah. Just a thought.
Which I really don't like acronyms, right? They're just they're like sort of
no. I take them out of copy all the time.
Yeah.
If you're going to say the whatever it is, like long thing that ends in organisation, at the second reference, just say organisation. Don't say the TCRPO.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Right, but it doesn't include all of the specific examples of anti-Semitic behaviour. The reason why this has upset a large number of people.
Including what, 68 rabbis?
68 rabbis. I mean, it is a really remarkable feat.
Number of rabbis.
To give you an idea of, I mean, it really is kind of a huge cross-section of theological, socioeconomic, and political opinion within British Jewry that has signed this letter. I mean, to give you an idea of it, of those 68 rabbis, not all of the 68 would agree with me that there were 68 rabbis signing that letter, right? You know, that really is, in fact, a
that
fun game if you're
into
theological disputes, which of course I am, is to try and work out what the lowest number or what the lowest number you would get if you asked all of the signatories how many rabbis have signed this letter, right? So, I mean, this is the thing. And a lot of the time when outriders will try and defend the Labour leadership, they will kind of say, oh, you know, You can't, there is not overwhelming unity or blah, blah, blah. And of course, you see the same game when the Conservative Party wants to go, oh, well, actually, you know, the Muslim community doesn't all feel the same way. Mm-hmm. Actually, this is an issue in which you can say, no, look, there obviously are always people who disagree with any given opinion, but actually this is as close to unity as you could theoretically conceive. The thing which a lot of people object to is that it feels that the specific examples that have not been included are the examples that people in the Labour Party have tended to do, right?
Like, can we go as far as saying they're the ones that would specifically mean that Corbyn and the leadership's allies would have to be removed from the party?
Yeah, I think the thing is you can say that it is partly about protecting elements within his own base. The question, of course, we've been asked is, does that mean that the Labour Party is institutionally racist? As far as I'm concerned, because I feel I haven't burned off any subscribers lately.
Well, let's go by the McPherson report,
McPherson
which is into
definition is open and shut. So yes, they are.
So the McPherson report, which was the report into the Met's handling of the death of Stephen Lawrence, said that oppressed people have the right to define their own oppression, essentially, yeah. Right? And that if you ignore that, if you have, in the case of that saying, the black community saying we are being disproportionately targeted by, say, stop and search, policing is happening in these ways, that if you don't listen to that, that you disregard community opinion like that, then that is institutionally racist. And I think that, unfortunately, unless you want to rewrite that definition, then there's no way to say that the Labour Party isn't ignoring the broad spectrum of British Jewry on this is anything else.
Yeah, and of course it is true that it is... Well, actually, I was going to say, I don't find it galling. I actually find it faintly hilarious that a large chunk of the Conservative Party has decided they actually do like the McPherson definition after all in this specific instance. Yeah, obviously it is hypocritical, but I'm really tired of the two political parties treating racism like first past the post. You know, like, oh, you know, we're 1 millimeter less anti-Semitic than they are Islamophobic, therefore we win. Or
that's the thing I think has become really distasteful about it. So Michael Fabricant, the Tory MP, put a horrible tweet up at the weekend in which he showed Sadiq Khan was Sadiq Khan as a balloon being shagged from behind by a pig balloon?
Yep.
Right? I'm trying to remember who was the pig and who was the balloon. But
who was the pig and who was doing the porking?
Oh my God, I can't believe you said that. But nonetheless, it was a fairly obvious reference to the fact that Sadiq Khan is Muslim, originally doesn't eat pork. Like, if you'd done that to a Jewish MP with a pig balloon, I think people would have gone, But the Bloc defence was, yeah, but Labour's well anti-Semitic. So, and you're like, okay, both things can be true. Labour can have a problem with anti-Semitism, and you should also not have Tory MPs posting Islamophobic tweets about the Muslim mayor of London. How could, like, these two things can coexist, people? But both parties have now got a convenient thing where they just do whataboutery.
Yeah, and the follow-up question we got from the same person is, what does this mean for democracy? And
bad,
I suppose the
things?
Answer, I'm just going to play a tape of my own inner screaming for
Yeah, I just think that's the problem, is that when you have in a situation in which people are just clearly using these things, only caring about racism when it's as in, when it suits them for partisan reasons, is not a situation that you want to have. Like, I just think that's a really, it cheapens the entire cause on both sides, I think, because it just makes it look like actually people don't care about the principles at stake.
I mean, part of me, I think we should start doing Norm Watch, but that would mainly be me saying, why is Esther McVeigh still in her job every single week? Isn't that really troubling? But this is yet another one of the many norms that does deeply trouble me.
Which is what I've written my column about this week, actually, is that we're seeing an exclusive preview of that, which is about Nigel Farage and him being treated as still like the kind of kindly uncle joke fest. And there was a tweet by BBC's this week that was like, ho, 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 people say he's on TV too much. We've got two of him here. And you're like, the guy spoke at an Alternative for Deutschland rally hosted by an MEP who was the granddaughter of Hitler's finance minister, who called for illegal immigrants to be shot at the border and said barbaric Muslim rapists were on the rampage in Germany.
Like, yeah, and he leads no party, and he has no right. You know, there is simply not a good enough argument for a public service broadcaster to A, feature him that much, but also B, do a hilarious joke about it.
Right, and this is the thing. Just because he was once leader of UKIP and they did once get 4.5 million votes, none of those things are true anymore. So why is he still on there, and why is he still being treated as a kind of lovely cartoon uncle rather than held to account for endorsing really despicable views with his presence? We're not at a time when should be complacent enough to be making jokes about this stuff. Well, that was a brisk end to the podcast, Stephen.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Stephen Bush, and my colleague Helen Lewis. It's recorded by India Bork and produced by Caroline Crampton. Our music is Devil by the Devil, licensed by Creative Commons. Subscribers to the New Statesman get more, including a free weekly guide to what's coming out in books, music and film, written by yours truly. So subscribe now at www.newstatesman.com/subscribe.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.